It is great to be here with you this morning, and I really appreciate the invitation from the leadership of NBC to actually come and talk about a really, really difficult topic. In fact, a very heavy topic, but a really important one, and one that has probably touched all our lives in some way. Understanding suicide was the topic, and I've changed it a little bit because I'm not sure anyone can understand suicide. And particularly when someone who follows Jesus decides to end their life at their own hands. I don't think we can understand that. And for me personally, February last year, one of my colleagues who I considered a friend, a PhD, a professor, a psychologist, took his own life. And then in May last year, another colleague, PhD, trained as a psychologist, took his own life. So in the space of that short time, two Christian men who I considered friends ended their lives, and somehow my brain wants to make sense of it, but I'm not sure I ever really will. But I want to share some thoughts that actually can help us to unscramble a little bit about that, make a little bit of sense of it, but I don't think we've totally understand it. Why is this such an important topic? Suicide is the leading cause of death in Australians aged between 15 and 44. To put this into context, we hear so much about domestic violence, and we should, and we're told that one woman is killed per week by domestic violence. And let me be really clear, that's one woman too many each week. We shouldn't have that. And our governments have thrown billions of dollars into domestic violence resources, and yet we have a much bigger epidemic that doesn't seem to get in the media very often. So if we look at the statistics of homicides, nearly 8 people per week are killed through homicides, of which 5 are men. But when we come to the topic of suicide, we're talking nearly 8 people per day. And just over 6 of those are men per day. And if you follow the media, you'll see little stories about it. And currently there's some stories in the media talking about particularly our returned servicemen, our young men who have done service overseas who are ending their lives. And it's tragic. And it frustrates me immensely that there seems to be a disproportionate focus in our media and our governments when we've got this glaring problem, particularly of young men in our country. The number of suicide in boys aged 15 has rose 77% in 2017. And the most at risk group is our 15s through to the 40 age group. Most at risk. I picked up just one article from Online News Corp, and if you look at the date, you'll notice there, June 11. So it's pretty recent. And the article says, Australian men are in crisis with suicide rates rising. Meet some of the men who'll die this week. Aussie men we all know. A farmer, a teen, an Aboriginal person, a miner. Everyday sort of people. It's very, very common. And therefore, I can assume that nearly everybody in this room knows somebody's life who's been impacted by suicide. I can be really candid and say that suicide has not crossed my mind in my life. But I can tell you, other thoughts have crossed my mind, like when I was going through a very difficult time in church leadership and I'd come home from some difficult meetings and I'd slide in beside my bed on my knees and I'd pray, Lord, I've had enough. Take me home, please. And then I'd wake up in the morning bitterly disappointed that I was still here on earth. I never thought about ending my life, but I prayed plenty of times that God would take me home. So we all can respond when we're in these overwhelming situations. And I'm going to explain a bit more about that. But before I want to start with that, I want to talk a little bit about death and loss and grief. And then I'm going to answer a whole heap of questions. And to start with death, loss, and grief, we need to understand a context. In Genesis 1 and 2, which is a great passage of the Bible, there's so much in 1 and 2. And often we just think that Genesis 1 and 2 is about creation, but it's not. It's actually about a whole heap of stuff about how God has put things in place, a plan, an order, a structure throughout his creation. In fact, a few years ago, I did a 6-part sermon series titled Return to Eden, which was all focused on Genesis 1 and 2. And it was about relationships, human sexuality, addressing contemporary issues. Because Genesis 1 and 2 is just full of it. And what we can take at the very end of Genesis 1 and 2 is that Adam and Eve were naked and there was no shame. And at the end of every day that God created, he sat back on his veranda and had a cool drink or a cup of coffee, and he said, "It is good. It is good." So if we go to God's created plan, is that he's created us for relationship, for connection, for life. That's what all 1 and 2 is about. And then Genesis 3 happens. And if we be theological, we talk about the fall of humankind. But in Aussie speak, I call it the big stuff up. The greatest stuff up of all time. That Adam and Eve rejected God's plan, thought that they could be boss of their own lives. And what happened was brokenness entered into God's creation. Broken relationship. And as a result of that, death entered into the world. And theologically, we often refer to that as the curse. The Bible talks about it as the curse. And what God did was when he banished Adam and Eve from the garden, he took an angel to put and guard the way to the tree of life. Now, this is profound. This is the very first act of grace in the Bible. Because imagine if Adam and Eve in a fallen state had eaten of the tree of life, then what we experience now would be our eternity. Now, I don't know about you, I think that would be very sucky. So God's act of grace is to protect them. Now, the problem is we have a real dilemma because we're created for life and relationship, for connection with God, connection with one another, and death is foreign to how God has wired us. So what happens is that Genesis 3 on, our normal experience is that we normally experience loss, death, broken relationship, but it's abnormal for how God has created us and hardwired us. And therefore, that's why grief at its best makes no sense. Grief and loss at its best is confusing because we're trying to sort out something that's a normal human experience that's abnormal to how God's wired us. Now, if that's the case, how more confusing is it when we actually have traumatic loss? When we lose someone through traumatic circumstances, and the most traumatic of all is when somebody chooses to end their life at their own hands. I'm not sure we're supposed to make sense of it all. I think it reminds us of our humanity and our aching that this is not right, that there's something really, really wrong. So what does the Bible say about suicide? The date, 1651, is a really important date in this topic. If you wanted to do a word search of suicide, you will not find the word in the scriptures. The reason being is that pre-1651, it was known as self-murder or self-killing. Suicide only entered the Oxford English Dictionary in 1651. And that was a result of some writings of a medical practitioner in the late 1640s where he actually coined the phrase suicide, and then there was a change in the language from self-killing or self-murder. The Bible does say a few things about it. And it's really interesting when we come to the Bible, because as I study the Bible, I get asked lots and lots of questions, particularly in one of my specialty areas around relationships and sexuality. And I go, you know, if it's a really important topic, you'll find a lot of verses about it. So the number one topic talked about in the Bible is money. There's over 2,000 verses. Human sexuality, there's only 170 plus versions. And so those verses and comments is that I think God says, this is really important. You're smart enough to figure out some of the other stuff. In the Old Testament, there's only 5 accounts of suicide. And if you look up there, you'll see them. And you can, you know, if you want to rip your phone out and take a picture, you can do that and look at them. But if you look at all those 5 accounts, there's a common thread. And the common thread is they were in overwhelmed circumstances and they thought ending their life was a better option to facing the circumstances. That's the overwhelming of those 5 cases. Jesus doesn't address the topic of suicide. Some may think that he should have, because when we go to the New Testament, is that we have one account of suicide. And who's that? Judas Iscariot, who spent 3 years hanging out with Jesus as one of his mates. And I find that really interesting because Jesus says to him, go do what you must do, which was about selling him out. But I think Jesus knew what Judas was going to do. And we don't see Jesus condemning him. There's one other account of attempted suicide in the New Testament, and that's when Paul was in the jail and the Philippian jailer after the earthquake was going to kill himself. And Paul says, hey, stop, we're here. You don't need to do that. So then, if the Bible doesn't speak to this topic directly, how do we make sense of it? We need to look a little bit of history to understand a bit about this. So the ancient Greeks and Roman times saw that if you ended your own life, if you took your life, it was honourable. In fact, in some, that was your way to secure your salvation. Not an uncommon thought even today amongst the Islamic community, where we see Islamic terrorists who believe that by killing themselves and killing others in the process is that they end up in paradise. It's been around that sort of thought for a long time. Stoics saw it as a triumph over individual fate. Early Christians knew that they would face death for following Jesus. Now, technically, does it fit into suicide or not? No, but they walked head on into really dangerous situations because they were sold out for Jesus. In church history, Augustine is pivotal. And Augustine is one of the early church fathers who's done a lot of significant teaching that still stays with us today. And you know, if I had more time, I could actually talk about some of his teaching around relationships and sex that's still around today, that's not based in the Bible, it's just his teaching. But he was the strongest voice against self-killing based on the 6th commandment that you shall not murder. And the whole teaching that has come around that those who take their lives don't end up in heaven is really comes from Augustine. If we move to more of the modern era, is that with the development of social sciences and medical sciences that we actually started to take a different view to it, that early social scientists thought that it was to do with some sort of dysfunction or something going on that led to that, and then medical science thought with that. And if we come to modern medical science, where we can scan people's brains and we understand the whole field of mental illness so much better, is that today we know that there's a correlation between mental unwellness and particularly depression and suicide. We know that people, when they get unwell, particularly in their brain, is that the risk of this increases. It's very interesting that in the 19th century, is that suicide was decriminalized, because if someone died by suicide, is that you didn't have a funeral, the family disinherited that person, and sometimes the survivors were prosecuted. So if they didn't succeed, they would be actually prosecuted. And as our understanding has changed, so has our responses. So does someone who commits suicide go to heaven? I can't say categorically yes or no. But what I do know is this, is that God loves me so much that he sent his only son into the world to live on my behalf, to die on my behalf, so that I could be rescued into relationship with the Father. And I think that's true for anyone who reaches out to him. And I think that God understands confused, broken people. That God, as the perfect Father, when one of his created beings, one of his sons or daughters, is in so much turmoil that they actually make that terrible choice, I think he grieves. I think he cries. Like any parent who hurts over their children hurting. And some of us will know that experience of having children struggle with mental health issues or to be in a terrible place. It breaks our heart. And I know that God is a God of grace. And God's the one who knows the state of somebody's heart in spite of the confusion in their head. I hold on to that dearly. So why does suicide happen? What we know is that when people become overwhelmed and distressed, whether that's with mental illness or life circumstances, is that the brain changes. And for some people, when their brain changes, is that their brain does what it's designed to do, which is solve problems. But sometimes when the brain is under distress, it doesn't solve problems well. It's amazing, for the most advanced computer that we have in the whole of the universe, is that some people's problem solving is, I'll end it. Now, some of those people, or nearly all of those people, I would say, don't necessarily want to die. They just want the circumstances, the pain, the agony to stop, and this is a problem-solving strategy to make it stop, but it's a sucky problem-solving strategy. Because the problem doesn't go away, they just leave it for all the living behind, all the loved ones have got to deal with all the mess and the unanswered questions. But they're not thinking straight, they're just saying, I want it to stop. Just like when I slid beside my bed and said, Jesus, take me home, because I just wanted the mess to stop. I just wanted the difficulty to go away. And my brain said, the easiest way for this to go away is ask Jesus to take me home. But for others, they say, I just will do this because this is the solution. And when their brain is messed up, things go really tricky. Sometimes they go on and say, the world's better without me. My family's better without me. And they think some crazy thoughts in that problem-solving strategy. And they're confused. And it's interesting because when, as a counselor, is that when I work with people who have suicidal thoughts and we unpack it, they're often facing hopelessness, despair. They see no other alternatives. And what they really need is love and compassion and grace, not judgment. So why does God allow this tragedy to happen? Recently, Jeff Vine, and if you listen to Vision Radio, Jeff Vine's an apologist, runs a church in Orange County in the States, but his early life, we worked in Zimbabwe as a missionary, then he pastored a church in New Zealand, so he's quite a unique American, and he loves coming to Australia. He says, we have the best coffee in the world, okay? And he says, when he walks out the gates, he says, it'll be another 12 months before I have a decent cup of coffee, all right? And he was at our church, and he was actually preaching a message based on a book that he's written called Dinner with Skeptics. And the first skeptic came with the typical line that if God's a good God, why is there evil in the world? And he pointed out as an apologist to the person, he said, that's a self-defeating argument. And the person looked curious at him and he said, if you assume there is good, then by default, you're assuming that it is evil. So if you assume that God is good, you have to assume that there's evil. And you can't blame God for that. He said, secondly, if you want God to address that disparity, you'll be the first to lose. Because God has given you free will to choose good or evil. And if you don't want to live in a world that has the dichotomy between good and evil, then God can take that away and take away your free will so that you do what he wants and have no decision, no choice. See, God could have made us all robots, robots who love him. But does God want that? No. God wants to be chosen. And dare I say, all of us want to be chosen. Isn't the whole romantic notion and relationship based on that? You know, someone's going to choose to love me, warts and all. That's the greatest thing about being married to Neroli, is that she knows me and she still chooses me of her own volition. There's the power of free will. But the dark side of free will is that people can choose evil, harm, destruction. So if we want the tragedies of the world to stop, we have to be prepared to give up our free will. A passage that helps me with this is Romans 8. And it's a fantastic passage to make sense of this. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. This creation waits in eager expectation for the sons and daughters of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into its glorious freedom of the children of God. And Paul says in another passage, in a moment, in the blast of the trumpet, in the twinkle of an eye, that which is mortal will become immortal. That is, temporal will become eternal. He goes on to say, we know that the whole of creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to this present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit grown inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons and daughters, the redemption of our bodies. I love this passage because it flies in the face that only good things happen to good people. That when you become a Christian, you're not going to have any challenges. No, no, no. We live in a whole world that is out of kilter, that is groaning like a woman in childbirth, and therefore we will have times when we will groan because it's not the way God planned it. This is not heaven. Heaven is the place of no pain, no death, no suffering. This is the prelude. It's not even the first chapter. It's the preface. And sometimes bad things happen to good people. And we groan because people make terrible choices that affect us. How does Jesus respond to these tragedies? In the shortest verse in the Bible, John 11:35, Jesus wept. But most of us don't understand some of the context, which can be quite subtle. If you go back to right at the beginning, the story says that Lazarus was sick and they sent word to Jesus, and Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death." And he stayed with his mates for two more days. Then word had come, and Jesus said this in verse 11. After he heard this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going to go and wake him up." The disciples, they said, "Well, Lord, if he's asleep, let's go and join him." Because they thought he meant natural sleep. And if Jesus was an Aussie, I think he'd make a great Aussie. He would have said, "Thick heads, he's dead. Let me be blunt." Then he goes to the situation and he says to Mary, "Your brother will rise again." So on those occasions, Jesus clearly knew that this was going to end with Lazarus' death. He knew the next move was he was going to raise Lazarus to life. So then why did he stand outside the tomb and weep? Now, some theologians have come up with different answers about it. Being a simple bloke at times, I think it was really simple. Jesus' mate was dead, and in Jesus' humanity, he experienced the pain of loss and death of a normal event that is abnormal to his humanity. And he weeps. Now, I take great comfort out of this because I'm one of those blokes who weeps easily. But I take great comfort out of it because even though you might know the next move, it doesn't negate the human experience of grief and loss. In my family, at family funerals, people avoid me. A number of years ago, my Uncle Rob, who was the most significant man in my life, died at the age of 60 with liver cancer. And we're at the cemetery and his casket's in the ground and I was sobbing my heart out, and someone came to me and tried to comfort me. But you know, when we're awkward, we always comfort people probably in the wrong way. And sometimes we say things that make us feel better, not the other person we're trying to comfort. And they said, "It's okay, Peter, he's gone to a better place." And I looked him square in the eyes and I said, "That's great for Uncle Rob. But how does that ease my pain?" And they sort of hopped away with a foot in their mouth and said, "Well, don't talk to him." So at family funerals now, people avoid me because I'm brutally honest. Because in my humanity, I have a right to the confusion and the pain of wrestling with something that is a normal human experience that is abnormal to my hardwiring. That when I love somebody and I lose them, it hurts. And that is a good thing. That's true for Jesus. So how does Jesus respond? I think he responds with tears. I think he responds with a broken heart. I think he responds with compassion and grace. A couple of years ago, I was here and invited to talk about mental health issues, and I based the message around this story. And just a quick summary of it, it's my favourite story about mental unwellness and depression in the Bible. And so Elijah takes on a challenge with the prophets of Baal and Asherah. And if you read the story, there's this big challenge over fire. And what happens? God turns up, poof, The people kill all the false prophets. And you think that Elijah would have been pumped because he just saw the greatest miracle of God. If I was there, I think I would have been pumped. You know, would have been punching the air and singing worship songs to God. You know, I might even become like one of the young, you know, they jump up and down and in a mosh pit. I probably would have done that. I would have been excited. But then this Queen Jezebel says, I'm going to have your guts for garters. And he's seen the mighty work of God and he does a runner and he finds himself under a broom tree and he's depressed and he says, I think I want to end my life. I'm done. And then it says, the angel of the Lord came to him and woke him up and said, listen, there's food here, eat the food. There's drink here, drink. Eat and drink and rest. You've got a long journey ahead of yourself. The angel of the Lord doesn't criticize him and say, listen, thickhead, don't you remember what happened on the mountain? Why don't you have more faith? No, he didn't get that. He got understanding. He got compassion. He got your physical needs to be met. And then he ends up in a cave bemoaning his sorrows. And God says, go out to the front of the cave. And God doesn't turn up in the wind or the storm or the lightning or the earthquake. God turns up in a gentle whisper and says this, buddy, you're not alone. You're not alone. One of the most preventative things against suicidal thinking is meaningful connection. Not being alone. Because when we're alone and our brain's messed up, we can do some terrible stuff. But we're not alone. And Jesus said to his disciples, go into the nations, make followers, but remember this, I am with you always. And so Jesus would say, buddy, you're not alone. So the challenge for us is how do we be with people when they're really struggling and hurting? How do we be with them so that they're not alone? And I just want to put a little twist on this, is that if we read the scriptures, God's heart always goes out to the marginalized. And the very foundation by the booths of the Salvation Army was to the marginalized, was it not? You mention the Salvation Army to non-Salvation Army people and they'll think ministry to the marginalized. They won't use those words. But when it comes to suicide, somehow we don't see those people impacted or struggling as marginalized. They are. And they actually need to reach out to them and a helping hand so that they're not alone. So how can we intervene? What can we do? Well, I'm going to share 5 tips with you about engaging in conversation. The worst thing that we can do, and practitioners are really terrible at this, is we pull out our check list and start asking questions. Tick, 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 tick. That doesn't help. We need to engage in honest conversation around hard topics. So when the invitation came to come and tackle this topic, I put my hand up, go, yeah. It's a great topic to talk about. In fact, it's the first time I've talked about it in a church. It's such a heavy topic that we tend to avoid it rather than talk about it. And the tricky bit is finding how do we talk about it in constructive ways, helpful ways. I came across a training package by Dr. Sally Spencer Thomas, who's a psychologist, and it was a training package that she teaches professional counselors and psychologists about how to engage in conversation. So I've taken and stole this from her and tweaked it a bit. So the first step is this. We need to notice. We need to tune our eyes and ears to notice things. So what do we want to notice? We want to notice changes in mood. We want to see if people's mood significantly shifts. We want to see if there's a change in behavior patterns. And when we're dealing with family members, the first clue is change in sleep patterns. We know from modern medical science that when people's brain gets unwell, the first place you're likely to see it is in their sleep patterns. What makes gaming addiction so difficult to deal with is when the kids get hooked into or adults get hooked into online gaming is that their sleep-wake cycles flip. So they stay awake gaming to ridiculous hours and then want to sleep during the day, and then that messes up their whole brain and physiology. It's really difficult and challenging. So we want to notice those, and we want to notice changes in life circumstances, because when some people face some really big stuff, they get overwhelmed. And then that has a knock-on effect to the change in mood. So we want to notice changes in people's lives around us. We want to be attuned to that. With this, we want to respond earlier rather than later. So many times is that we notice stuff, but we don't know how to have the conversation, so we don't say anything. But we need to have the conversation sooner rather than later. The earlier, the better. Second step is to explore what's behind this. And one of the ways to say that, listen, I've noticed your mood has changed, or I'm noticing that you're facing all this stuff. Can we talk about it? Can you help me to understand? Can you tell me more? What's really going on for you? What's it like for you at the moment in those circumstances? And one of the problems is that often in our church communities, we're really good at offering answers. Just have faith. Lay it at the foot of the cross. You know what? For these people in these situations, that doesn't help. What we need to do is use our ears and our eyes to listen four times as much as we speak. Get them talking. Tell me more. I don't understand this. Help me to understand more. As we listen, we want to identify the pain points in their life. And mostly it'll be psychological pain. Sometimes it's physical pain. But we want to connect with the weightiness of this. And one of the ways to do this is go, wow, this is happening. This is happening. You're experiencing this and this. Man, that sounds so weighty, so heavy. And I want to connect with the pain points of the enormity of what they're experiencing so that they get a sense that one other living, breathing person gets the weight. Because in that, then they don't feel alone. Once we've got the pain points, then we want to move towards the suicidal thinking. And the easiest way to do this is I go, wow, you know, sometimes when people have so much weight, they feel so overwhelmed. They don't see a solution. Is that sometimes they think about taking their own life in suicide as a way of solving the problem. I'm wondering if that might be the case for you. I'm wondering if you've had some of those thoughts. Now, sometimes people will go, yeah. Sometimes they'll brush it off and you need to come around it again. I say as a clinician, I say to people all the time, you know what, when we're under incredible stress and pressure and we're not doing well, it is not abnormal to think about suicide. But it is abnormal to make a plan and do it. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. If you don't get the answer and you just know it's not right, they're not telling you the real truth about it, then what you need to do is that you need to do a gentle assumption. So you assume that they're thinking about it. And then you approach that. Something like this. I wonder how many times suicide or ending it has crossed your mind, even fleetingly. That question catches people off guard because they answer it before they've realized they've answered it. It's a great little question. I wonder if you've thought about this at some stage, even just for a passing moment. And what it does is it normalizes it, because there's been so much shame around this topic. And shame forces every one of us to keep stuff in secret and hiding. The things we're shameful about, we cover up. And the remedy to shame is to expose it to the light. But in this topic, how do you expose that if you don't have somebody who's with you and helps you to unfold it? The next step is getting help. So what you need to do is you need to go with them to the right professional. Don't take, here's Peter Janeski's number, ring him. Because you know what they're going to do? They'll say to your face, yeah, I'll do that. And then they'll just put it in the car, in the bin. They won't follow up. Because sometimes they're so overwhelmed, they don't have the capacity to go. So sometimes we need to say, hey, can we access some help together? I'll go with you. I'll go with you. So where are the places we can go? Well, first of all, there's a whole heap of online resources like Beyond Blue. And Beyond Blue's got resources not just for people who are suffering, but resources for people who think, someone in my family's not doing well or my friend's not doing well. How do I get my head around that? And you'll go find all the checklists that you need to have to go, yeah, I think this is it is. Now, how do I have the conversation? The first point of contact with a professional generally is a GP. Now, here's a tip. If you're going to take someone to the doctor, to a GP, when you book the appointment, you must ask for a long appointment. If you just make an appointment, you'll get your 10, 15-minute appointment. It's not enough. And under Medicare, a doctor can have a long appointment, and it's covered. So you've got to say a long appointment. And I say to people all the time, you've got to find a GP that people connect with who are not just, you know, churning people through at the practice. They're actually people who really connect with their patients. And we've got some wonderful GPs in our country, Christian and non-Christian. And in spite of all the faults of our health system, we have the best health system in the world. We really do. And if you want to check it out, talk to someone who's migrated to Australia and ask them about our health system, or talk to a refugee. They'll tell you bluntly, we've got the best health system in the world. And we take it for granted often. Our hospitals have got great mental health sources. So if you're really desperate with someone, you go to the hospital with them. Yeah, it might take half a day. But that person then knows that they're not alone. They're not alone. Nearly had to do this with a friend of hers. And as I was walking to the hospital, the friend said to Nearly, can you hold my hand, please? And Nearly said, sure. What's going on? And she said, I just feel like walking out in front of the traffic. If you hold my hand, I know I won't. Took half a day, but it was worth it. It's worth it because people matter to God. For teenagers, we've got Headspace, and I'll be really candid. Headspace offers some great services, but it's a bit hit and miss. You've got to find the right Headspace. And Headspace as an organisation, they contract out to others, and so they're trying to lift the standard all the time. But there's great resources there. The Christian Counselling Association of Australia, you can go to their webpage. They've got a search engine. You can find Christian counsellors right around the country. Same with PACFA, which is a professional body. Christian Counselors Association is part of PACFA. It's a secular organisation. They have a search engine, can find counsellors all around the country. The Australian Psychological Society, you can actually find psychologists all around the country. So there's lots and lots and lots of resources that we have. But as part of that conversation is that if we find someone we're concerned about, is that we need to go with them and connect them with the right resources, and it takes time. But it's worth it. Worth it because everybody matters to God. And rather than have this topic be shameful and that we avoid it, maybe with those conversations we'll open up and we can turn the tide of the statistics. Maybe we'll actually have more people reaching out for help. In fact, it's my belief that the agent for change in this area is the church. And the reason I believe that is because we believe in the redemptive power of Jesus. We believe in the healing power of Jesus, don't we? And we need to be the conduits of connection with people who are struggling, Christian and non-Christian, and to find pathways where they can experience healing through natural ways as well as supernatural ways, and to be connected and not isolated. In a moment, I'm going to pray. The worship team's going to come up and the prayer team's going to come up. And I'm going to pray, but can we stand? I'd like you to stand. The worship team can come on up and the prayer team can come up. Let's pray together. Lord, this is a tough, weighty topic. It's a topic that touches so many of our lives. Lord, as I've journeyed more recently with the loss of two friends by taking their own lives, I still shake my head and can't get my head around it. I can't get my head around that two men who love you got to a point where they thought that this is the only option. But Lord, I hold on to you, that you are the God of all wisdom, of all knowledge, of all understanding. That you're the God who knows the hearts, minds, and the working of the brains of each one of us. And that when we struggle, it impacts you. Lord, I know that some of us are touching a sore topic that is causing pain and grief for us. And Lord, I want to pray that you'd be in the presence of that grief as we work through the confusion of something we're not wired for. Lord, I know there's probably some here who have had those thoughts. And I want to pray that you'd help them to have the courage to reach out to someone they trust and say, this is what's going on. And that they would begin a journey of incredible healing and freedom and grace. Lord, meet us. Remind us that you are with us in a very profound way today. I pray this in your name, Jesus. Amen.